Good afternoon and welcome to Time Out, your program of informative interviews with persons of note, persons with fascinating careers, leaders of today and tomorrow, and others who will allow you to invest an hour and receive a guaranteed valuable return. This is Bill Hendrickson, your host of Time Out, talking to you from a rainy Carrboro, North Carolina. And this is really, for me, a very, very special time, because we're talking with Coach John Donowski. And John Donowski has been kind of part of our family since my grandson was a Duke student about 6-8 years ago. And it's great to have a chance to talk to you, Coach John.
Well, thank you so much, Bill, for this opportunity, and I'm excited.
Well, I don't talk to coaches. I never was an athlete because I was always nearsighted when I was a youngster. And when I was in high school and college, I didn't do any sports. But you went through Rutgers playing lacrosse. Didn't your father play football?
You're right. My dad actually went to Fordham University, graduated in 1932.
Wow.
Back in the days, Fordham was in the metropolitan New York area, college football was a big deal. They played home games in the now torn down Polo Grounds, where the New York Giants baseball team played. They played in Yankee Stadium.
Is that right?
In fact, they played, they beat Alabama when my dad, I think, was a junior, 2-0 in front of 60,000 people at the Polo Grounds.
Wow.
They would, the big game, one of their big games of the year was NYU, where they played NYU in Yankee Stadium, in front of 65,000 people. So, back in the day, Fordham football was all the rage before professional football really, hit its stride. And then afterwards, my dad was drafted by the Giants, played for the New York Giants for 8 years, went into the Navy, and then joined the Navy like many men in his. In fact, it's a famous football game. They were playing on a Sunday afternoon when the announcement came over the loudspeaker that the Japanese had just bombed Pearl Harbor. And so many of the men in the next month or two, end up enlisting. And my dad then spent 4 years in the Navy.
Well, didn't your dad give you a football when you were a young kid?
Well, yeah, I played high school. Obviously, I played junior high school. And when I went to Rutgers, my scholarship actually was for football. I was a recruited quarterback. In those days, we had a freshman team. I played freshman football. After my freshman year, freshmen were allowed to play varsity. So instead of having a freshman team, we had a JV team. I played JV as a sophomore. And then as a junior, I lasted about 3 weeks into preseason, and then decided it was time to hang it up. One of the biggest regrets of my life, but I did play lacrosse throughout my 4 years at Rutgers.
What was the biggest regret? What's the bigger regret of your life?
Hanging up, even though I wasn't. Your ego. You get so caught up with your ego and the fact that you're not the starting quarterback and you're not you're not playing and. I wish I would have stayed. I wish I would have stayed for a variety of reasons looking back now. But it's one of those things that my first year out of college, I was coaching JV football at Jericho High School while I was earning a master's degree in counseling. And I remember having a football in my hand at one of the first practices and saying, wow, you don't get it back. You don't get the chance back to play again. And I had squandered, in my opinion, 2 years of being able to be part of a team, to go out to practice every day, and you don't get that opportunity again.
Well, how was your emotional capacity switching from football to lacrosse. And they're two different worlds and two different styles of play.
Well, you know, back in the 70s, many of us were recruited to play two sports.
Oh, is that right?
In fact, you know, my high school, East Meadow High School on Long Island, probably 70% of the football team played lacrosse. Our coaches coached football. Our lacrosse coaches coached football. Or you could say our football coaches coached lacrosse. Uh-huh. So for us, it was just a very easy transition. And even some of us, you know, I know I did. I played basketball in the wintertime, and some of my friends wrestled. But, you know, being a two- or three-sport athlete back in the day was just what you did. In the fall was football season, and the winter was hoops, and the spring was lacrosse.
Well, you started coaching lacrosse at CW Post. Is that where you got your first coaching experience with lacrosse?
Actually, I had coached a couple of years as a junior, a middle school lacrosse coach in New York State. Uh-huh. They have a very high-functioning middle school, junior high athletic program.
Is that right?
And so not unlike here where that doesn't seem to be the case. I worked in the Belmore Merrick Public Schools, and I worked at a junior high named Jerusalem Avenue, and I would go over to the other junior high in the district and coach. So I coached at Merrick Avenue Junior High. I was a JV lacrosse coach at Seaford. I was a JV lacrosse coach at East Meadow High School. And at the time, I was not a full-time teacher. So, you know, you were looking for part-time work as I was supplementing my income. And so I did get to coach on the middle school and JV level.
Okay. So as a full-time head coach, where was your first full-time head coach job, at Post or at Hofstra?
Actually, at Post. I was the assistant coach to Tony Seaman my first year. And then I was recently married. And because I had a master's in counseling, I was able to run a residence hall while I was at Post. So I made $6,000 as the resident hall director.
Right.
And then two meal passes for us when school was in session that we could eat in the dining hall. And then $4,000 to be the head lacrosse coach. So it was, it was a great time in our lives. It was a lot of fun. And I did that for 3 years while I was at CW Post.
Well, Hofstra is an interesting school. I had to read about it. I used to live in New Jersey for many years and was obviously affiliated with the New York environment. But I knew Hofstra was there, but I didn't know anything about it. And I read about it. It sounds like quite a fascinating private school.
Well, it's, you know, Hofstra, the only reason Hofstra sometimes gets a bad rep, I think it's just in its location. It's located on Hempstead Turnpike, which is a busy thoroughfare that cuts right through the middle of campus.
Yeah.
There's no campus town per se, but they're you know, at its height, about 4,000 students living on campus. And, you know, during our time there, met some just phenomenal people, people who I worked with. There was a time where Jay Wright, who was the head basketball coach at Villanova, he was our basketball coach.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Gardy, who was our football coach at the time, he hired some amazing people. Dan Quinn, who was the who unfortunately just got fired as the head coach of the Atlanta Falcons in the NFL, was one of our assistants. Raheem Morris, who was the head coach of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Danny Quinn. I mentioned Danny Quinn.
Yeah.
I think Dave Brock, who was the head coach at Delaware. Kyle Flood, who was the head coach at Rutgers. They all worked on the same staff together while we were there.
Isn't that amazing?
Tommy,
well, how did you recruit? Because you developed a strong program while you were at Hofstra. I guess I would kind of say you single-handedly built that program. So how did you recruit people to Hofstra who might have been recruited by people at bigger colleges like Maryland or Cornell or other areas? How do you recruit?
The beauty of Hofstra was we had a very strong education program. And so if any of our students were interested in becoming, you know, physical education professionals, where a lot of guys, you know, were attracted to that, that was a strength for us. The business, another strength for us. You know, there were some students that wanted to stay close to home. And so we had to identify those students. Long Island is a hotbed. There's probably 100 high schools within a 40-mile radius of the university. So that was a possibility. We looked in areas where we knew people, upstate New York, Corning, New York became kind of a pipeline for us, you know, for a little while. The Maryland area, we would try to pluck one or two students a year from Maryland if they were the right guys. And then we had some transfers that came back as well. You know, guys who maybe didn't have the experience they were looking for away from home and didn't mind coming home. You know, playing at Hofstra Stadium, we played Johns Hopkins, I think my second or third to last year, in front of 7,000 people on a Tuesday night. Wow. So it was a great place to play. It's an exciting venue. And when it was the right place for the right guys, then we had good teams.
Where did you play actually?
We played right on campus. It's called Hofstra. Well, now it's Short Stadium. Uh-huh. It seats around 12,000 people. In fact, in 1999, we played in front of the biggest crowd in the history of college athletics on Long Island. We played Johns Hopkins in the NCAA playoffs in front of 12,000 people.
So you played some of the same teams that you've been playing at Duke.
Yes, we played Carolina. We played Duke, actually. My last 3 years while I was at Hofstra, we beat Duke 3 years in a row.
Is that right?
Yes.
So they put you on the list to get you down here in North Carolina as soon as they could.
Well, I'm not sure that was it, but it didn't hurt, that's for sure.
Okay, so you're here now at Duke, and you've had an amazing career here. I think you've won, three national championships at Duke?
Yes, sir.
We can talk just a minute about this year's final. It was just an amazing final, playing up to the final game, which you were not in, which was an amazing game itself.
I mean, yeah, you know, this year was... It was so bittersweet in that we were able to play, you know, like a lot of athletes who didn't get a chance to, you know, really play lacrosse this year. The university did a fabulous job in providing all the support that we needed. During the course of the spring semester, we COVID tested every day. So we had over 7,500 tests where we only had two positives, which one we thought was a false negative. But we were able to travel. We were able to do all the things. And at the end, you know, somebody's got to win. Somebody's got to lose. And you know, it's the old saying, we picked a bad day to have a bad day. But to get to the semifinals in a year like this, to continue to be able to allow to play at a high level, very proud of our team, very proud of our staff.
Well, you had a great year with some great guys, and I assume a lot of them will be back next year. Or this coming year, but the final two games of the season were so unique in your day, a game against Maryland and then Maryland's game against Virginia. I mean, those two games just don't match up.
Well, Virginia, you know, it's every day is different. You know, Virginia came in last place in the ACC.
Yeah.
And you had
beaten them.
Yes, we beat them during the year. And they got hot at the right time, but they had some really very talented older players who have been through this before. And, you know, they just put winning ahead of everything else. And they had a younger player and, you know, Schellenberger, who had a great championship game. And the pieces really seemed to fall into place for them, you know, at the right time. So you got to tip your cap and congratulate them and look forward to playing them again next year.
Well, I'm sure you will. Well, the recruiting must be that must be your life during the time the season is on. Now the season is off. Are you recruiting?
We are. Recruiting here is a little different. And first, you know, we have a very strong academic profile. And so you can go out and watch players in the summertime. You can watch club lacrosse tournaments. But everybody can see the talent, see the potential or an athlete or a skilled player. But the thing we have to look at first and foremost is the academic transcript. And for our students, they have to have A's and B's. You can only have maybe one C on your transcript.
Uh-huh.
They've got to take two to four AP courses, you know, advanced placement.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be in an honors track for the most part of their high school career. And their, you know, their standardized test scores have got to meet a certain minimum. So while it would be nice to say that, you know, we could go out and just, hey, he's a really good player, let's offer him, you know, it's not possible. So it's a little trickier, but in our sport, there's enough talented, bright young men out there who are interested in Duke, and so we just have to find the right match.
Well, I obviously, when my grandson was at Duke and on your team, I think I went to almost every home game, even though I'm an old person. I had to almost climb the fence, but I got in there. But it lacrosse seems kind of like a family sport. There's always parents. And before the Duke games, they always had a party in the parking lot. And the families, my grandson's family still is friendly with other families from student days. What brings this family culture to lacrosse?
You know, it is an interesting phenomenon. It's something that didn't exist when I was in school, but the parents do enjoy, and that's at every school. They do enjoy tailgating. They do enjoy, spending time together, and they do make friends. And at the end of a 4-year career, I don't know who misses it more, whether it's the players, the students, or the parents, because a large part of their social life in the springtime was centered around, you know, what's the schedule like? Where are the home games? Who are we playing the away games? Do we get a chance to be in the playoffs and do this for another week? I think the parents get a bigger kick out of it sometimes than the guys do.
Well, my grandson, of course, didn't come to Duke with a scholarship, but he tried out in front of you, and you took him on as a scratch player. And I think that accepting him to the lacrosse team at Duke really helped him get through college education, because he spent time practicing lacrosse or working out at the gym, keeping his health up and going to class a few times. I know he did his classwork okay, but the lacrosse, the way he got accepted at Duke through trying out in front of you and you were accepting him, was a strong motivation for him and for his life. That was an example to him of how if you try hard and you work out and you have somebody patiently watching you, it helps your overall success in life.
There's no doubt that Will is a great example of every year we do take a look at one or two walk-ons. We call them walk-ons, students who were accepted by the university through the normal admissions process, who played lacrosse in high school and, you know, want to give it a try, you know, at this level. Now, this level is not for everybody because it is all year round. You know, as soon as school begins in August, we're in the weight room 4 days a week. We start running in preparation for fall practice. We practice 4 days a week during the fall, starting in late September. And it's a lot, you know, it's a lot. But we think that it's certainly worth it at the end. And, you know, as soon as you step on campus, you have 45 brothers.
And,
you know, you have 45 friends. If you're a freshman, you know, there's 10, 11 seniors. And, you know, there's you get your fellow freshmen. But, you know, all of a sudden you've got this cohort of young men who have a similar vision, you know, who want to play on the last weekend, who want to have this extraordinary experience, you know, while they're on campus. The academic part just goes hand in hand. Mm-hmm. You know, this past semester, our team GPA was 3.447.
Wow.
We don't have a player on our team that has a cumulative grade point average under a 3.0.
Mm-hmm.
So every member of our team has a 3.0 or better. You know, the competitive fires not only exist on the field, but in the classroom as well, because the guys know that that's going to lead to that next thing in their lives. You know, whatever that is, you know, whatever they choose. Some of our guys choose the military. Some of our guys choose to go into coaching, God forbid. Mm-hmm. Imagine that.
Yeah.
Some of our guys, you know, go to Wall Street. Some go to law school. Some go to med school. You know, it's whatever is going to make them happy, you know, at the end of the day. But, you know, it's that desire to be extraordinary that bonds all of them together.
And your son, Matt, is your number one assistant. How's the father-son teamwork as father coach and son assistant coach?
It's interesting, you know, and I would say this, anybody who's ever worked with their son or daughter, you know, one of the things that you need to do, you know, I think as a manager, you need to let the people underneath you fail in order to be successful, in order for them to figure it out, in order for them to, just like you need your students to fail every once in a while, not fail too often and not fail, but you need them to. And so there are times in our relationship here professionally where I really have to bite my tongue. You know, I want to step in and say, let's do it this way, or why don't we try this? And I will, you know, if I really think it's necessary, but there are also times where you have to let your, you know, the people that work for you fail a little bit in order for them to correct and change and know that they're trusted. And, you know, I trust Matt implicitly. He cares deeply about Duke. He cares deeply about the program. You know, he's very bright when it comes to lacrosse. But it's a, as a dad and as his boss, it gets a little strange sometimes, for sure.
Well, I guess you'll keep it that way until one of you goes until one of you goes somewhere else or something
exactly.
Like that.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, tell me a little bit about the sport itself. I mean, I've watched it, and how do you set up a score? How does your team set up to score a point?
You know, I think if for the folks who are not really used to watching lacrosse, it's very similar to basketball. You know that if you know the game starts with what is called a face-off, very similar to a jump ball.
Yeah. Well, let's start with a face-off because you've had good success with face-off players. What makes your face-off players a little more swift and successful than the other teams? What is it about a face-off player that makes him successful?
Well, the face-off, it's a very unique position, and it's 20 years ago, anybody who faced off still played in the game. They're a midfielder, and midfielders play both offense and defense in the game.
Right, yeah.
Now, face-off men are what they call FOGOs. Face-off, get-off, meaning just win the face-off, throw the ball to your teammate, and get off the field. And so they become highly specialized.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Almost like kickers in football, where you come in, you do one job, and then you get out.
Uh-huh.
And or, you know, a relief pitcher in baseball. Come in, you know, a short reliever, come in for one inning, don't hit, don't do anything else, just throw 10 pitches.
So that's your face-off job now, is to be the face-off and you're out.
To get possession. And anything over 55% we deem as successful. So if we can get the ball back 55% or more off the face-off, you know, that's our goal each week. And And basically, the referee puts the ball in between the two player sticks. He backs away a couple of steps and then blows his whistle, similar to a hockey face-off, maybe.
Uh-huh.
And it's all about timing. It's all about your ability to anticipate and then react to the whistle. And once you hear the whistle blow, to be able to gain possession of the ball. So it's very quick. It happens, you know, in a matter of seconds. Sometimes they're extended. We call them kind of scrums where nobody picks up the ball. But, you know, probably 75% of the time, possession is gained within 2 or 3 seconds of the whistle being blown.
Mm-hmm.
And it's timing and anticipation.
So the positions, your midfielder and your forward, and your, of course, you have your at the other end, you have your goalkeeper. But what are the unique qualities of each of these positions? What's the unique quality of a forward position?
Well, first, you know, the midfielders traditionally are your best athletes. They have the ability to run the field. The field is 80 yards from goal to goal, 110 yards long behind, because there's areas behind the goal where you can play, unlike soccer and unlike basketball, and maybe a little similar to hockey, but there's a little more distance behind the goal. And so the midfielders are your best athletes. They're the guys you ask to do the most. Play offense, play defense, you know, run without the ball, run with it. Your attackmen, those are the guys who play closest to the goal, and they're your most skilled offensive players. They're your quarterbacks, the high IQ. They possess, you know, the best stick skills on the team. While the middies, certainly the midfielders, have good stick skills, the attackmen traditionally have, you know, superior. And then on the other end, defensively, we've got three defensemen, you know, who play with longer sticks in front of the goal. And their job is to defend, you know, the attackmen. And they're usually bigger. Well, I won't say bigger, but they're stronger. They have a defensive mentality, a defensive mindset, almost like an offensive lineman in football. I'm not going to get any glory. Nobody is going to know who I am. I just got to show up and do my job every day. And then, of course, we have a goalie in our sport, and, you know, the goalie is got to be have great reflexes, great anticipation, got to be a little crazy.
That's a tough job, boy.
Tough job, right? The best shooters shoot anywhere from, you know, 90 miles or an hour or more. And so, you know, got to be smart and play the angles and, you know, and have great skills and great leadership. And you have to have that, you know, the mentality where if I give up a goal, it's okay. You know, I've got to make the next save, the next opportunity. You know, I've got to let whatever happened before, I've got to let it go.
So aren't there certain rules about the timing of a ball, how long it can hold a ball? Are there timing rules within the game that allow the ball?
The only timing that we have is when the goalie makes a save and gains possession of the ball, that he's got 4 seconds to get out of the crease. He is protected by the crease only for 4 seconds. And we say 3.5 seconds, because if you're in there for four, the official will blow the whistle and then award the ball to our opponent.
Uh-huh.
Now, once we gain possession of the ball, any player, we have 20 seconds to advance the ball over the midfield line.
Wait a minute. 20 seconds from the time the ball is pushed out by the goalie, he has 20 seconds to get the pass midfield.
Yes. So we got to go 40 yards, and, you know, the opposing team is now what we call riding and trying to get the ball back. It's like either a half court press or a full court press in basketball. So they're trying to regain possession of the ball, and we're trying to clear it. And so we've got 20 seconds now to get it over that midfield line. And then in the college game, the last 3 years, we now have a shot clock. We never had a shot clock before.
Yeah.
And so now we have an 80-second shot clock.
80 seconds?
80 seconds to get a shot off.
In other words, from the time you have the ball, you can only hold it for 80 seconds. Is that it?
That's it.
Oh.
Now, if you go to a high school game, high schools don't play with a shot clock. So, you know, the rules are a little different depending upon the levels that you watch and the areas of the country. You know, they adapt certain rules and they try to adapt as much as they can to the college game. But, you know, right now it would be difficult financially, you know, for schools to have a shot clock.
That 80-second rule is new, isn't it?
3 years.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember going to the games when my grandson was there, and somebody, and you didn't have the 80-second rule. That was 8 years ago.
Right, correct. Yep, that's a relatively new rule, and it's a good one. It's sped the game up. I think it's a more enjoyable game to watch, and it's something everybody can relate to because you do have a shot clock in basketball. You know, you've got a play clock in football. You can kind of you see on the field. So it's something that people in the stands can relate to.
Where do most of your scoring points come from? Front rack, right in front of the goal, or I see a lot of angle shots that go in and pat and make a point.
Well, it depends upon your talent. You know, your attackmen are traditionally your highest scorers because you don't really substitute your attackmen. If you have three, you normally play three, and they play closest to the goal. And because they play closest to the goal, you know, they traditionally will be your, you know, they'll score the most points. Your midfielders will substitute midfielders because they get tired. And we'll run just like similar in hockey, where you see different lines come in and out. You know, we'll play as many as four midfield lines in a game. And so by playing, you know, by subbing people in and out, they're fresh. You know, they can go. They can keep up with their opponent. Midfielders traditionally will score from the outside. They'll score when they cut to the goal, like in basketball, very similar when you cut to the hoop and somebody feeds you a pass. And so, you know, those guys have got to be able to do, you know, a couple of different things.
Haven't I seen some midfielders of yours be good scorers?
Yes, very much so. We've had guys like Miles Jones and Demer Klass and Dave Lawson and Jake Trapuka, Josh Offit. Some of them have been terrific players, All-Americans. This past year, Nekai Montgomery was a midfielder. And he was a first-team All-American.
Okay. So I'm learning a lot about the sport, and this is great for me, and it's going to be great for our listeners because the sport is it's not a money sport like pro football or pro. You do have a pro league, I understand, but lacrosse is not a big money sport. It's a great sport to watch and for kids to play. But it hasn't attracted a big investment to make it a money sport. What is the difference between it and some of the other sports?
You know, part of all of us, I can speak for my generation, I can speak for younger, you know, players, we kind of like it that way. It hasn't been commercialized. It hasn't been, you know, I hate to use the expression bastardized, but it hasn't been changed for the most part. The game is about the people. It's about it's about the friends that you make along the way. It's about the competition. It's about it's about so many things that are just there's no as you said there's no money involved here. There's no rainbow on the other end. So it's not like the people are, you know, playing the game in hopes of signing a big contract one day.
Yeah.
They play because they love it. They play because they love the game. They love their teammates. They love the travel and the experience and the competition. And they know that it's a means to an end. When you play in college, there's something greater for you on the other side. And that's, you know, that's going to be your relationships, your family, your profession. You know, all those adventures that are waiting for you on, you know, on the other side of your college career.
Well, you have some professional leagues, I guess. Is there an overall corporation that controls the professional side of lacrosse?
Well, there are two professional leagues. One is an indoor league that's played in hockey rinks. And it's
played in hockey rinks.
Hockey rinks. It's called the National Lacrosse League. And it's the Canadians have played indoor lacrosse or box lacrosse, you know, for years now. And so basically the game was created when the rinks dried up in the summer, in the summertime, the Canadian kids play lacrosse. And so the league is dominated. The league has been obviously shut down the last 2 years. But there's just there were two new franchises that were rewarded. One is in Las Vegas, and one is going to be in Dallas. The one in Las Vegas is going to be owned partly by Drew Brees and Wayne Gretzky.
Oh, really?
they're two of the owners. So okay. It's and Wayne Gretzky grew up playing lacrosse as a youth indoor. So it's the indoor game is very different than the outdoor game. I can't really speak too much of the indoor, but the outdoor, there's a league called the PLL, the Premier Lacrosse League, which is in its third year of existence. Financially, it's probably struggling a little bit because in the summertime, people have things to do. Their business model is a barnstorming one where, for example, this weekend, they have 8 teams in the league. And they'll play one game Friday night in Baltimore. They'll play 2 games on Saturday and then 2 games on Sunday. And then next week, they'll go to, let's say, Minnesota and do the same thing. One game on Friday, 2 on Saturday, 2 on Sunday.
So how long are the games? The same duration as college games?
No, it's a little different. They play with different rules. They play with a shorter shot clock. They play on a small field because their guys aren't in good a shape as college guys are. They don't practice.
Oh, they don't?
No, they just get together. If they're playing on a Saturday, they might do something on a Friday. But I think there's only like 18 guys who suit up, so that's not even enough to practice full field. So they'll get together and get organized. But then they'll play on the weekends. But it's equal for everybody.
So they don't make their living playing lacrosse.
No, there are no full time. There are some guys who will play in the indoor and the outdoor league. But right now, because of the pandemic, Canadian players who don't have their are not allowed to cross the border. So they're kind of stuck. And the indoor league was shut down for the last 2 years. So there's been a little bit of that going on. The hope is that. Once next year rolls around, things will, get back to normal.
Have some of your players, both from Hofstra and from Duke, gone on to become coaches, lacrosse coaches?
Yes. Besides my son here at Duke,
obviously
we have Ned Crotty, who's also here on the staff, who played here at Duke. We have Brad Ross is the assistant coach at the U.S. Naval Academy. Justin Turry is the assistant coach at Michigan, and Kyle Turry, his brother, is an assistant coach at Hobart. Guys who did not play for me played for Coach Pressler. Mike Murphy is the head coach at University of Pennsylvania. Taylor Ray is the head coach at St. Joe's. Kevin Cassis is the head coach at Lehigh, and Dan Shamadi is the head coach at Richmond. So we've got 4 former Duke players that are head coaches. We've got 4 or 5 who are assistant coaches in college. Probably 8 or 9.
Do all the major colleges that have the big state schools and the big private schools, do they all have lacrosse teams?
No. Lacrosse is only about 72 schools that play now.
Is that all? 72?
That's it.
Wow.
And so, for example, in the Atlantic Coast Conference, there's only 5 that play. But in the ACC, there are 10 women's teams that play. In fact, Clemson just announced recently that they're going to be adding women's lacrosse. And Pitt is going to add women's lacrosse this year. I think will be the first time that they'll be playing. They'll be competing. So the ACC will have 10 teams.
Okay, so I want to – you most of your students come from – private schools rather than public high schools. And that's, I've looked at the score sheets of other schools, and it's the same way. Lacrosse seems to recruit and successfully recruit from private high schools. What's the situation there?
Well, I think there are two reasons for that. One is that academically, many of those kids come from families that prepare them a little bit better academically for acceptance into these schools. Also, they come from families who have a little bit of extra income that allows their students to play in the summertime and travel, to be on club teams and travel. And there are kids from California, for example, who come east. They'll come east for 4 or 5 weekends in the summer to play in club lacrosse tournaments, and in order to be seen. And so, you know, the combination of the academic piece, the little bit extra income, it kind of shuts out, you know, that public school athlete in our sport. You know, the public school athlete is not that he couldn't play, but then because there's only 12.6 scholarships in men's lacrosse, it's very difficult for them to finance their education as well. So, you know, we spread out our scholarship money among about 23, 24 different players. So some will only get, you know, $5,000-$6,000. Some will get, you know, $20,000-$25,000. But school costs pretty much close to $80,000 this year coming up.
Uh-huh.
So it makes it very difficult for a lot of those public school families, you know, to be able to afford.
So probably a lot of public schools don't even offer lacrosse as a sport.
No, actually, there's more public schools that play than private schools. You know, on Long Island, there's probably 80 or 90 public schools that play.
I should tell our listeners how you usually do this in the middle of the show. You're listening to a conversation with John Donosky, the head lacrosse coach at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. And we thank all you listeners for supporting WCOM. You know, WCOM is the community station here in Carrboro, North Carolina, and we're supported by people in the community. And you folks listening can send a check to WCOM at the in Carrboro, or come and slip it under the door here at the studio. We'll give you credit. This is a nonprofit organization, and any money that is paid to WCOM is a tax write-off for the donor. And we want to thank you all for this. You can go to our website, wcomfm.org, and make a safe and secure donation. And I'm going to tell the show will be over in a few minutes, but I want to make sure that you all understand that we appreciate your listening, and we appreciate your support, and we appreciate that today we can have almost an hour talking with John Donosky. And boy, this has been a great education for me, because I've gone to those matches and I've watched these guys running back and forth. And you've helped me help our listeners understand some of the mechanics of the game, because it's a unique sport. And we've watched basketball and football, and we've come to be familiar with that. But lacrosse is so unique, and the players all seem to be so tuned in. To every player seems to be knowing exactly where that ball is going to go next time. How do the players really stay so tuned in to the action of the ball during a play before it gets shot toward the goal?
Well, you know, we like everyone, you know, at our level, during the fall, we practice 4 times a week for 6 weeks. During the spring, we'll practice 5 days a week. So the amount of practice, the amount of repetition that you get constantly, you know, allows you to anticipate. We always say that there's a we want to provide structure so teammates can play together we also, the players have to supply some discipline in order to, you know, execute that structure. But if you have structure and discipline, that'll give you freedom. That'll give you freedom out there to make a play, because the game is spontaneous, happens very quickly. You have to make decisions in a split second, but you really can't optimize any of that without structure and without discipline. And those are the first two things that are necessary in order to be successful. And I think that with those two things, that allows guys to follow the ball, anticipate, be in the right spots at the right time.
So structure and discipline is coached by you and your staff. Is it the same structure and discipline that would be coached at UNC or at Maryland or Virginia? Or do you all have your own style, or do you all use the same style?
No, everybody's got a different style, and that's the beauty of it. You know, I am heavily influenced by my junior high and high school coaches. I believe really strongly in the fundamentals of the game, and having a really strong background in just the basics. And that allows you, the better you are fundamentally, the stronger you are fundamentally, the more fun you're going to have in the game. And I believe in that. And, you know, every coach has got their nuances and subtleties. But, you know, I think if you watch Duke play relative to some other schools, you know, you can, after a while, you'll notice some of the differences.
Well, it's been great talking with you today. I wish we had more time, but we don't, because all shows are a little bit less than an hour. Next week, we'll be also talking with another well-known Duke professor, Prasid Kasabatla. He is an Indian, but he also is known at Duke because he's one of the top professors in environmental science. So that's next Monday's show, and we'll keep eyes on you. I hope you stay here a number of years, John, to keep the things going.
Bill, thank you. I'm going to stay here as long as they'll let me stay.
Okay, well, I'm sure that all the families that I know that are lacrosse sports will write to the trustees of Duke and keep that man here.
It's been great. All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
It's been great talking to you and learning a lot about your sport. And that's all for today, folks. We'll talk to you next week.
way.